and outdoors trade show in Las Vegas. Schedule permitting, we would go every year to meet with vendors and see what kind of new guns and equipment were on the market. The first day of the trip, I introduced him around to all the vendors. By the second day, my contacts were asking me where Walt was hanging out. At a bar after the show the third night, I found Walt holding court with executives from the National Rifle Association. He had a cigar in his mouth, and he was slapping backs and shaking hands like he was running for office. They all loved him. Walt was the little guy with the big personality. The team had a quick huddle, and I told them the goat trail idea was scrapped. We were now going to patrol up together. "We are going to go up the main trail and adjust as we get closer to the target," I said. "Any issues?" Everybody shook their heads. "No." "Nope," Charlie said. "We're good." It was like playing pickup basketball. We knew what needed to happen, and all we needed was the basic plan. If you know how to shoot, move, and communicate, the rest will fall into place. When operations get too complicated, it tends to slow things down. Every single man standing in the weight room that night had years of experience. Plus, the plan always changed, so it was easiest to keep things simple. We'd done this before and trusted the team. The patrol snaked out of the gate and started down the paved road toward the village. It was a nice road, probably built with American tax dollars. Less than a kilometer from the gate, we slowly fell back from the main group before taking a right turn and heading up our valley to the west. We followed the road for 2 hours. It cut back and forth with each switchback steeper than the last. Soon we came upon a cluster of cars. I could see a Hilux truck parked on one side of the road and two station wagons with racks on the roof. As I passed, I gazed into the windshields. All of the cars were deserted. This was as far as they could go. It was the end of the road. The trail narrowed and got steeper as we patrolled deeper into the valley. With every step, I could feel the altitude and the weight of my equipment trying to slow me down. I was getting tired, and we were only halfway. I hoped all this effort was going to be worth it. After another hour on the trail, I could see the target compounds, and at least two small faint lights on near one of the buildings. Clumps of trees blocked most of my view. The buildings were made of stone and mud and seemed to emerge from the valley walls. Taking the main road the rest of the way would have been easier, but we knew there were sentries watching the route. We couldn't risk being compromised. The drones continued to report roving patrols in the trees around the main road and compound. Surprise was key. In most cases, the quickest way between two points in Kunar was a goat trail. I'd heard the same line in Alaska growing up. We had no choice but to find another way around. Nobody wanted to be in that valley when the sun came up. "We're going to move directly up the ridgeline and move our way around," I heard the recce team leader say over the radio. I could almost hear my leg scream, but we all knew it was the right call. The recce element was confident that if we shot straight up the ridgeline, we'd find the original goat trail that my team was going to use. From the road, we literally climbed up the mountain searching for the goat trail. Several times, I had to tighten the sling on my weapon so I could grab boulders in front as I climbed. If I wasn't pulling myself up the side of the mountain, I was making my own switchbacks as we climbed. No one spoke, but I could hear my teammates grunting as they climbed. We all saw this as a juicy target. We were willing to do it if we could get the jump on them. Still, with every step, the only thought running through my mind was the target better be worth it. After a couple of hours of climbing, we finally found the goat trail. My legs were beyond sore now, and it was tough to catch my breath because I was tired. But making it to the trail gave us renewed hope. Without a doubt, our recce guys were the best in the business, and if it weren't for their meticulous planning before the mission, there is no way we would have ever been able to pull off this operation successfully. The goat trail wasn't wider than a foot and straddled the ridgeline. On one side was the cliff face towering over us, and the other side was an almost straight drop into the valley. We didn't have time to dwell on how a false step could send you sliding down a near vertical face. We just spent an hour finding the trail, and dawn wasn't that far away, so time was of the essence. We had to move. We finally caught a break when the trail emptied us out into a perfect position slightly above the target compound. There were three central buildings with a courtyard in the middle and several additional small structures scattered around the perimeter. At the foot of the trail were a series of fields cut like stairs into the rock face. It was between seasons and the dirt was dry. Sometimes the fields were flooded and we'd have to slog through the mud. Setting up on the tiers, my team took the one that was level with the main target compound. "Alpha is set," I said over the radio. Steve's team climbed up one tier above my team and moved to the right flank.
"Charlie is set," Steve said on the radio.
Bravo team climbed down one tier to focus on the southern compounds farther down the hill.
"Bravo is set."
I could feel the adrenaline start to flood my body. I no longer felt tired or sore. Each one of my senses was heightened, and we were all on full alert. If everything went according to plan, we'd catch the enemy by surprise. But if things went bad, we'd be in a gunfight in close quarters.
"Take it," Troop Chief said over the radio. "Nice and slow."
We started to creep forward. Everyone was quiet, and each step was deliberate.
Nothing got our blood pumping more than creeping into an enemy compound,
sometimes directly into the rooms of enemy fighters while they were sleeping. This wasn't like other units that had to react to a roadside bomb attack or ambush. This was deliberate and calculated. Our tactics weren't unique. What made us different was our experience level and knowing when to take violent, decisive action and when to be patient and quiet. I could feel my heart beating in my chest. Every sound was amplified. We'd take four or five steps and hold. Shouldering my weapon, I focused on my laser as it tracked from window to door to alley, searching for any movement. I could see my teammates' lasers doing the same thing.
"Go slow," I thought. "Slow is quiet."
When I got to the first building, I tried the rusty knob of the thick wooden door. Locked. Charlie tried the same kind of door on the building right next door. It was also locked. There was no talking. We didn't have any fancy Navy SEAL hand and arm signals. I just nodded at Charlie, and we started to move around the building to the other side that faced the courtyard. A small gate led into the courtyard. Walt reached up and cut the cord that held up a sheet that blocked the way. Moving inside, Steve, Walt, and the rest of the team stacked on multiple doors across the courtyard. I saw a recce sniper with a thermal scope on the roof starting to scan for sentries in a dried-up creek bed that ran north to south along the perimeter of the compounds. My team's point man led us through the same gate, and we approached the front door of our building. Walt tried the door of his building, and it was unlocked. He slowly pushed it open and saw a man messing with a flashlight. As Walt walked into the room to subdue the man, another man sat up from under some blankets. He was wearing a chest rack, and he had an AK-47 next to him. Walt and another SEAL who entered behind him opened fire, killing both men. Across from Walt's room, Steve opened the door to another room and found a group of women and kids. Leaving one member of his team in the room, Steve led the rest of his team to a door farther down the wall. A recce sniper on the back side of the building Steve's team was clearing was looking for roving sentries. As he scanned the road that ran up the valley, he saw a half-dozen Taliban fighters grabbing for their guns through a window. He immediately started firing just as Steve and his team reached the door to the room. Cracking the door open, Steve could see the fighters scrambling for cover.
"Frag out!"
One of Steve's teammates cracked the door just wide enough to toss the grenade into the overwhelmed enemy fighters. I heard the muffle of the explosion as shrapnel peppered the room, killing the fighters. Just as we reached the door to our building, I could make out the faint sound of a second sniper's suppressed rifle opening fire. A guard was sitting on a rock overlooking the main road. He had an AK-47 slung on his back and an RPG resting next to him. My point man pushed the front door open and cleared into the first room. The house had a dirt floor, and sacks of food, clothes, and cans of oil littered the room. Out of the corner of my eye, I watched as the point man opened fire. A fighter, gun in hand, was attempting to jump out a back window and escape. The bullets riddled his back and ass as he tumbled out of the window. Outside, I heard one of Bravo Team's squad automatic weapon gunners, or saw gunners, go hot.
"Wah!"
The machine gun rounds echoed across the valley. It caught me off guard because most of us were using suppressors on our guns to muffle the sound. "We've got movers coming from the north," I heard over the command net on my radio. We were starting to get reports that fighters were headed toward our position from farther up the valley. This target quickly escalated into 3 separate firefights, and now we had reports of additional fighters advancing on our position. The SAW gunner and Bravo team continued to maneuver just down the hill from us. One by one, Bravo team picked off at least 5 more fighters as they tried to move into fighting positions with RPGs and heavy machine guns. The SAW gunner fired another 30-round burst as he sprayed the last sentry hiding between boulders in the dried creek bed. Within minutes, I heard the buzz of an AC-130. On the radio, I could hear the troop commander passing word that the AC-130 was going hot on the movers to the north.
"You've got this," I told my teammate. I left him and another SEAL in the building while Charlie and I cleared an alley that ran between this building and the one below it. The buildings were on the same tiered steps of land as the fields where we had entered. The alley was narrow, and it was impossible to see the end because the walls were crowded with junk. I kept getting caught up in low-hanging clotheslines strung up between the two buildings. With a narrow alley like this, Charlie and I stood on opposite walls. I covered his side of the wall with my laser, and I could see his laser crossing the alley into the wall in front of me. It was all an angles game. We crept down the alley, being as quiet as possible. The key was throttle control. We'd go fast when we needed, but then go back to being slow and quiet. We were about halfway down the alley when Charlie opened fire. Pop, pop, pop. I froze. I couldn't see what was in front of me. Charlie let loose a short burst and then started to move forward. I glanced ahead for a split second to see a fighter crumble against the wall 3 steps ahead of me. As he hit the ground, he dropped a shotgun. Usually, we wore about 60 pounds of gear, including those ballistic plates to protect us from gunfire. Charlie wasn't wearing his plates, either. When we cleared all the way to the end of the alley, we paused to get our bearings. "If I get shot tonight, no one better tell my mom I didn't wear my plates," I whispered to Charlie.
"Deal," Charlie said. "Same goes for me."
A short time later, we heard the all-clear call over the radio. The target was secure. But now we had to do sensitive site exploitation, which we called SSE. Basically, we shot pictures of the dead, gathered up any weapons and explosives, and collected thumb drives, computers, and papers. SSE had evolved over the years. It had become a way to rebut false accusations that the fighters we killed were innocent farmers. We knew that within a few days after the raid, the village elders would be down at the local NATO base accusing us of killing innocent civilians. The kind of innocent civilians who we knew, and could now prove, carried RPGs and AK-47s. The more SSE we provided, the more proof we had that everyone we shot was guilty. "We're on a time crunch, fellas, so make it fast," the troop chief said. "We've still got movers to the north." His voice was drowned out by the sound of the AC-130's 120mm shells landing a few hundred meters up the valley. I checked my watch. It was well past 4 in the morning. We were running out of darkness, and since the shooting started, there was a steady flow of reports coming from the drones alerting us to more fighters coming our way. With the photos complete, we piled all the weapons and ammo in the center of the courtyard and set explosive charges on a 5-minute delay. With the recce guys in the lead, we quickly and quietly snuck back out the way we'd come. As we raced away from the compound, I heard the explosion and saw a small fireball light up the courtyard as the fighters' weapons and ammunition were destroyed. The walk back was easier than the walk up. We were high on the adrenaline of what we had just managed to pull off. Several times along the patrol down the hill, we had to stop and direct some additional close air support on multiple groups of fighters who were searching for us. We didn't want to be in the valley any longer than we had to, and definitely not at daybreak. 3 hours after clearing the compounds, we were back at the base. The guys slumped down along the walls, exhausted. Everyone was smoked. We sucked down water, power gels, pretty much anything we could get our hands on. In the operations center, we gave the captain all of our SSE. He could show the elders the evidence when they came down to complain. "We had 17 EKIA," the troop chief told the captain, meaning we killed 17 fighters. "We suspect another 7 or 8 dead from the AC-130. The army captain was stunned as he looked at the pictures on his computer. He and his men rarely got a chance to be on the offensive against the enemy. They were stuck protecting the villages and roads leading into and out of the valley. It felt really good knowing that we eliminated Taliban fighters harassing the outpost. On the helicopter back to Jalalabad, I finally had time to reflect on the mission. Sitting near the ramp in the dark, I was amazed that we were able to pull off an operation as dynamic as this one without taking any serious casualties. From the patrol up the mountain to the assault, it was a textbook raid, incorporating all of the lessons we had learned from previous missions. Instead of flying in and fast roping down, we snuck in, quietly. Instead of blowing open all the doors, we crept in and caught the fighters off guard. Instead of yelling and crashing through the buildings, we used suppressors and kept the noise down when possible. We used their trails and traveled light, and we had beaten them at their own game. All in all, we cleared an objective with more than a dozen well-armed fighters without taking one casualty. The raid was proof that good planning and the use of stealth was a lethal combination. Chapter 9. Something Special in D.C. I stood in my yard and ran my toes through the grass and looked up into the blue sky. It was the early spring of 2011. 3 weeks before, I had been stumbling over the thick gravel that covers the ground at the American forward operating bases and trying to stay warm through the cold Afghanistan winter. For months, it was nothing but ice, snow, and mud. After constant deployments since September 11, 2001, to one desert country or another, I had grown to appreciate the simple things, like a nice green lawn. I was glad to be home. The last deployment, for the most part, had been slow. Winter deployments often were, as fighters moved back into Pakistan to wait for warmer weather.
My 3 weeks of leave were winding down, and my troop would be heading to Mississippi to train.
I looked forward to getting back on my gun after the break. It was one of those trips where we could still unwind a bit and just relax. This would be the first trip in a long time that I wasn't going to be shooting with Steve. His time as a team leader was up. When we returned from the last deployment, he transferred over to Green Team to be an instructor. There was no farewell speech. We got back, put our gear away, and when Steve came back from leave, he kicked off as an instructor with the next class.
I was into work early that morning to get in a workout and get my kit together for the trip when I ran into Steve.
"I need a break," Steve said. "It has been a good run since Green Team, and with all the new rules, it has taken all the fun out of the job." "I hear you," I said. "Got one more rotation as a team leader, and then we'll see." Everyone in the squadron was a combat veteran. The average guy had at least a dozen deployments. Even with the pace and the sacrifices of being away from family, most of us kept coming back for more. "It's going to be a short break," I said to Steve. "You'll be back soon as a troop chief."
"So we can both learn the art of PowerPoint?" Steve said.
Everything in Afghanistan was getting harder. It seemed with every rotation, we had new requirements or restrictions. It took pages of PowerPoint slides to get a mission approved. Lawyers and staff officers pored over the details on each page, making sure our plan was acceptable to the Afghan government. We noticed there were fewer assaulters on missions and more strap hangers, each of whom performed a very limited duty. We now took conventional army soldiers with us on operations as observers so they could refute any false accusations. Policymakers were asking us to ignore all of the lessons we had learned, especially the lessons learned in blood, for political solutions. For years, we had been sneaking into compounds, catching fighters by surprise. Not anymore. On the last deployment, we were slapped with a new requirement to call them out. After surrounding a building, an interpreter had to get on a bullhorn and yell for the fighters to come out with their hands raised. It was similar to what police did in the United States. After the fighters came out, we cleared the house. If we found guns, we arrested the fighters, only to see them go free a few months later.
Often we recaptured the same guy multiple times during a single deployment. It felt like we were fighting the war with one hand and filling out paperwork with the other. When we brought back detainees, there was an additional 2 or 3 hours of paperwork. The first question to the detainee at the base was always, "Were you abused?" An affirmative answer meant an investigation and more paperwork.
And the enemy had figured out the rules.
Their tactics evolved as fast as ours. On my earlier deployments, they stood and fought. On more recent deployments, they started hiding their weapons, knowing we couldn't shoot them if they weren't armed. The fighters knew the rules of engagement and figured they'd just work their way through the system and be back to their village in a few days. It was frustrating. We knew what we were sacrificing at home. We were willing to give that up to do the job on our terms. As more rules were applied, it became harder to justify taking the risks to our lives. The job was becoming more about an exit strategy than doing the right thing tactically.
"Good luck," Steve said. "Who knows what we'll see next year?"
I laughed.
"BB guns, maybe," I said. "Tasers and rubber bullets?"
The command was small enough that I would still see Steve often, even if we'd miss him on the next rotation to Afghanistan. I quickly finished getting my kit ready and headed home. It was getting warm in Virginia Beach. Not hot enough to swim in the ocean, but nice enough for short sleeves. I was hustling to get some of the things on my to-do list done before I left again. The first one was new mulch for the house. When I got home, a beat-up old F-150 Ford truck was parked in the driveway. The mulch guy had a tarp laid out with a large mound covering it. He'd load up his wheelbarrow with a pitchfork and deliver a load to one of the flower beds and then come back for more. It was a one-man operation. As he loaded up the wheelbarrow, I walked over to shoot the shit. I'd never met him, but some of my teammates had recommended his work. Spreading mulch was something I should do myself, but with so little personal time, it was easier to pay for it.
"You're in the teams, right?"
the mulch guy said between scoops.
"Yeah,"
I said. From the look of him, he could have been a SEAL except for his long surfer haircut. He was tall and wiry, and he had tattoos covering both arms. He was wearing a ratty surf t-shirt and worn Carhartt pants.
"Figured. You looked the part," the mulch guy said, setting down the wheelbarrow. "I just did Jay's house. You know him?"
"He's my boss," I said. "We're actually headed out to do some shooting next week."
Jay was my squadron commander, but I didn't know him that well. He had taken over the squadron before the last deployment. He didn't go out on missions with us very often, so I never really worked with him. At his rank, he was typically found running the Joint Operations Center, JOC, and helping us jump through hoops to get missions approved. We sometimes called our officers temps because they showed up for a few years before moving on to check another box on their career path. They bounced from one job to another, never spending enough time to build the kind of roots that enlisted guys did. We tended to stay with one team for a lot longer. Jay was my fourth commanding officer since being at the squadron.
"I guess he's been pretty busy lately," the mulch guy said.
I was surprised, since we'd been off for the last 3 weeks. After a deployment, most guys just wanted to hide out. It was normal for someone at Jay's level to have work relating to mission coordination and planning. It just seemed strange that Jay was already so busy since we had been on leave.
"What are you talking about?"
"I did his yard the other day," the mulch guy said, between loads. "There's something big going on, and he's been up in D.C.
"What?"
I said, confused. "He's supposed to go to Mississippi with us in 2 days. At the time, the Arab Spring was raging. Egypt had a new government, and protests had sprung up across the Middle East. Civil war had gripped Libya, with rebels calling for NATO support. With hotspots in Syria, not to mention the Horn of Africa and Afghanistan still demanding attention, speculating on what could be spinning up was difficult. We were briefed weekly on any existing or expected threats worldwide. Our intelligence department went over each region in the world, sometimes with a special emphasis on a certain situation like Libya. The brief usually ended with the latest information and missions in Afghanistan and Iraq. The better informed we were, the more prepared we'd be. It wasn't uncommon for us to spin up on a mission, conduct rehearsals, only to wait for decision makers in Washington to approve it. Sometimes, like with Captain Phillips, we'd go. But most times, we'd just wait and eventually stand down. Over the years, most of us learned to keep our heads down and focus on the task in front of us and leave the speculation to others.
It saved energy, if nothing else. I wrote off the mulch guy and was thankful I was a team leader and not an officer. Officers get jerked around 10 times more than we do. Either way, I was ready to go have some fun in Mississippi. This trip to Mississippi wasn't like the time I spent down there in Green Team. I didn't have to worry about picking a bottom five or possibly being sent home for improper CQB. We'd spend half the day at the range and the other half running through the kill house, working on our skills and making sure everybody was in sync. We had several new guys in our troop and we had to make sure they were up to speed. No one really noticed that Jay and Mike, the squadron's master chief, who is the most senior enlisted SEAL in the unit, weren't there. But the mulch guy's words were stuck in my head. I wondered what was so special in D.C. We came home on a Thursday. On the way to the airport, I got a text message from Mike. Meeting 0800. Mike was massive like Charlie, with thick arms and a broad chest. He had been stationed at DEVGRU for as long as I was in the Navy. Like Jay, he didn't go out on many missions. On the way back, I found out some of the other guys in the squadron received the same message. Charlie called me the night I got back into town. "You get that text?" he said. "Yeah, you got any scoop? Heard anything?" I said. "Nope. I know Walt got it, too," Charlie said. "I guess there's some list." Charlie rattled off a few other names from the list. It wasn't whole teams, but senior guys. "I can't wait to find out what this is all about," I said. "Sounds suspect." I got to the command early the next day and changed into my working uniform, a Cry Precision tan desert pattern and Salomon low-top running shoes, and dropped my cell phone in my cage. The meeting was in our secure conference room, which meant no phones. The conference room was on a floor designated as a Sensitive Compartment Information Facility, or SCIF. SCIF is an area used to process classified or top-secret information. We had special badges that got us through the security doors. The lead-lined walls kept out electronic listening devices. Inside the conference room, the 4 flat-screen TVs were dark. There were no pictures or maps on the wall. No one had any idea what to expect. I grabbed a chair at the circular table in the middle of the room. I saw Walt, Charlie, and Tom, my old instructor from Green Team. He nodded when he saw me. Tom was Steve's old boss. It was odd not seeing Steve. I had deployed with him for the past 8 years. Even if this was a wild goose chase and we got jerked around, it was still strange to spin up on something and not have Steve around. I had a feeling when this turned out to be nothing, he would have the last laugh. There were almost 30 people in the room, including SEALs, an EOD tech, plus 2 support guys. With us all crowded inside the room, Mike sat down at the table and started the briefing. Jay, the squadron commander, was absent. Mike seemed a little uncomfortable and didn't provide a lot of detail. "We are going to do a joint readiness exercise and we're going down to North Carolina to train," Mike said, passing out a list of gear to pack. "I don't have a lot of information. Just load out your standard assault stuff and we'll tell you more Monday." I scanned the list. Nothing on the page, guns, tools, and explosives, was unique or gave away what we'd be doing. "How long are we going to be gone?" one of my teammates asked. "Unclear," Mike said. "We leave Monday." "Do we have berthing or do we need tents?" Charlie asked. "Berthing and chow will be provided," Mike said. A couple of other guys asked similar questions, but Mike shut it all down. I started to raise my hand to ask a question. I was curious how we were going to be organized. Overall, there was a lot of experience in the room. They'd drawn us from different teams. On most teams, the new guy usually carries the ladder and the sledgehammer. But looking around the room, we had all senior guys. It looked like some kind of dream team they were putting together. Before I got my hand up, Tom just looked at me and shook his head. I put my hand down. Tom typically never got too spun up. I was usually a little more vocal. My mind was spinning with questions I wanted answered, not knowing what we were going to do grated on me, especially with the feeling we were just getting jerked around. "Let's worry about the loadout," Tom said as we left, "and we'll know more Monday." We all knew what to do and the gear to pack. I went down to the cages and found one of my guys. "Hey, brother," I said, "I need to borrow your sledge." Senior guys grabbing gear like a sledgehammer was rare, which brought even more questions from our teammates. "You got it," he said. "But why again am I giving up my sledge?" I didn't have a good answer. "We're going on an exercise," I said. "They called a bunch of us into a meeting today, and we're going down to North Carolina. They're calling it a joint readiness exercise." I wasn't any more convincing than Mike. My teammate just looked at me with a what-the-fuck expression on his face. Back in our squadron storage area, we started loading two ISUs, small, square shipping containers, with our gear. It took most of the day, and by quitting time, the containers were filled with tools, guns, and explosives. While we packed, speculation was rampant. Some guys figured we'd be in Libya in a few weeks. Others bet on Syria or even Iran. Charlie, who seemed to be mulling over all of the questions and non-answers, came out with the boldest prediction. "We're going to get UBL," he said. Since there is no universal standard for translating Arabic to English, we use the FBI and CIA's spelling of his name, Osama bin Laden, shortening it to UBL. "How do you figure?" I said. "Look, when we were asking them about the plan, they said we were going to a place where there is a base with infrastructure," Charlie said. "If we don't need any of these things, we're going back to Iraq or Afghanistan. Somewhere there is an American base. I'd say we're going into Pakistan, and we're basing out of Afghanistan."
"No way," Walt said. "But if we are, I've been to Islamabad. It's a shithole."
Walt and I had already been on one wild goose chase looking for bin Laden and his flowing white robes. It was 2007, and I was on my sixth deployment. This time I was working with the CIA at Forward Operating Base Chapman in Khost Province. Khost Province was one of the places where the hijackers who crashed into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon trained. Al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters were constantly in the province, slipping easily in and out of neighboring Pakistan. About midway through the deployment, the whole squadron was called back to Jalalabad from multiple bases throughout the country. One of the CIA's leading sources on Osama bin Laden reported he saw the Al-Qaeda leader near Tora Bora. It was the same place U.S. forces almost captured him in 2001. The Battle of Tora Bora started on December 12, 2001, and lasted 5 days. It was believed bin Laden was hiding in a cave complex in the White Mountains near the Khyber Pass. The cave complex was an historical safe haven for Afghan fighters, and the CIA funded many of the improvements during the 1980s to assist the Mujahideen during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. U.S. and Afghan forces overran the Taliban and Al-Qaeda positions during the battle, but failed to kill or capture bin Laden. Now, the CIA source said he was in Tora Bora. "They saw a tall man in flowing white robes in Tora Bora," the commander said. "He is back to possibly make his final stand." This was 2007, and 9/11 was 6 years behind us. Until this point, there was no credible intelligence to his whereabouts. We all wanted to believe it, but the details weren't adding up. We were going to fly into Tora Bora, which sat on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border between Khost and Jalalabad, and raid his suspected location. It sounded great in theory, but the operation was based on a single human source. Single-source intelligence rarely added up. No one could confirm the report, despite dozens of drones flying day and night over Tora Bora. The mission was set to launch a few days after we arrived, but it kept getting delayed. Every day it was a new excuse. "We're waiting on B-1 bombers. The Rangers aren't in place yet. We've got special forces heading to the area with their Afghan partner units." It seemed to all of us that every general in Afghanistan wanted a piece of the mission. Units from every service were involved. The night before the operation was going to launch, they called Walt and me to the operations center. "Something came up and you two are going to work with the PACMIL," the commander said. "If we get squirters toward the border, we need you guys on the PACMIL side to coordinate blocking positions." "Are we bringing our kit?" I asked. "Yeah, bring all your op gear. You may be operating with the PACIs." Once on the ground, we got word Walt had to stay in Islamabad because the Pakistanis only allowed one of us to move forward. Since I was senior, the mission fell to me. An intelligence officer and a communications tech joined me. I spent the better part of a week in a small command center in a U-shaped building made of concrete. I watched feeds from drones doing laps over Tora Bora and monitored the radio. The night I got into Pakistan, the Air Force started their bombing campaign leading up to the team's air assault into the area. My teammates landed in the mountains high above Tora Bora and started to search the area for bin Laden and his fighters. I frequently called the PAKMIL into the command center to look at the drone feed. Once, the drone spotted what looked like a camp near the border. I could make out tents and several men with guns walking around the area. The men didn't appear to be in uniform, but the PAKMIL officers said it was a border checkpoint. It was awkward because I didn't know if I could trust the PAKMIL officers. Everyone had a different story, and I was stuck in the middle trying to keep it all together. The intelligence officer didn't help, and I felt like a politician trying to keep my hosts and my bosses across the border happy. After a few days of this balancing act, PAKMIL shut down my portion after the operation turned out to be a dry hole. There were no squirters, and the next day we headed home. Back in Islamabad, I met up with Walt. He was ready to go back to Afghanistan. For all the time and effort, we essentially bombed some empty mountains, and my teammates went on a week-long camping trip. There was no sign of any man in flowing white robes. When we finally got back to Afghanistan a week later, flowing white robes became an inside joke for a bad mission. This training exercise down in North Carolina sounded like another bad mission. But I wouldn't know until Monday. Unfortunately, I needed an extra day in Virginia Beach, which meant the whole team was heading down without me. I hoped my delay wouldn't cost me my slot on the team, just in case it was something big. I stressed to Mike that I could cancel my plans and come down with the team. "Don't sweat it," Mike said. "Just come down Tuesday morning." On Monday afternoon, I started texting Walt and Charlie, trying to get some scoop. Both wrote back basically the same message. "Just hurry up and get down here." They would have said something if it was lame. The lack of a response meant it was legit. I didn't sleep Monday night. I was up before dawn Tuesday morning, speeding through a pouring rain. I had to force myself to slow down on the rural roads. I knew something good was on tap, but I also didn't want to slide off the road and wrap my truck around a tree. The 2-hour drive on Tuesday morning felt like 8 hours. Finally, rolling up to the gate of the training base around 7 a.m., I met the guard. From the outside, it looked innocent, except for the screens hung along the fence to block anyone from looking inside. Giving him my name, which was on the list, I got my laminated security badges and headed to a building where the team was based. I kept my window down after speaking with the guards. The base was tucked into a pine forest. The morning rain brought out the scent of the trees. I was 3 hours early, but I didn't care. I was already a day behind. Not being there almost bothered me more than not knowing. There was no way I was going to wait until late morning to get started. I needed to catch up. A single-lane cement road led to a gate. Large, 10-foot-tall wooden security barriers lined the road, making it impossible to see inside the compound. Pulling through the gate, I started toward the parking lot in front of two 1970s-era two-story concrete buildings. As I pulled up, I saw two of my buddies walking into one of the buildings. I gave a quick honk and parked in a nearby space. They stopped and waited for me. A light rain was falling, and I hustled over. "You're early," they said. "We just finished breakfast. What time did you get on the road?" "Early," I said, skipping right to it. "What do we have?" I wanted instant gratification. "You ready?" Juan said, smiling. "UBL?" "No fucking way." Charlie was right the whole time. I couldn't believe it. Now all of the talk from the mulch guy made sense. Jay was in D.C. helping plan this mission.
"Yep, UBL," one guy said. "They found him."
"Where?" I said.
"Pakistan."
Chapter 10. The Pacer. They led me into a conference room that served as the operations center. Laptops and printers were set up on folding tables. Maps of Pakistan hung on one wall, including maps of a city called Abbottabad. All of the furniture was made of faux leather with understuffed cushions and metal armrests. The guys had pushed most of the lounge furniture to one side, next to the plastic plants, to make room for gear. The room was empty, except for a few civilians from the CIA working quietly. I tried to take in some of the maps and photographs, but it was all so overwhelming. I still couldn't believe they finally found Osama bin Laden. We had never had any good leads. He was like a specter hanging over the whole war. We all dreamt about being on the mission to kill or capture him, but no one really thought about it seriously. There was too much luck involved. We all knew it came down to being in the right place at the right time, and walking into the operations center that Tuesday, it appeared we were all in the right place. They had simply hand-picked the most senior guys in the squadron, rather than pull an existing troop. Mike walked up and saw us in front of the organizational chart. There were 28 names on the list, including an EOD tech. An interpreter and a combat assault dog named Cairo rounded out the team. Ali is a TERP from the agency, Mike said. TERP was short for interpreter. There would also be four alternates, in case someone got hurt in training. We broke everything down into four teams, and I've got you down as one of the four team leaders. Tom was also listed as a team leader. You'll be on Chalk 1 for the infill, Mike said. Your team is responsible for the guest house, C1, to the south. C1 was a designation for the guest house,
a separate structure from the main house in the compound, which was where bin Laden would most likely be living.
Chalk 1 and Chalk 2 referred to the two helicopters that would carry us on the mission. I noticed Charlie and Walt were also in Chalk 1,
but on a different team.
The mission was organized so that both helicopters had the same capabilities. Chalk 1 mirrored Chalk 2. I had an officer on my team who would step in if Jay's bird went down. Mike, our master chief, counted as part of my team, but once on the ground, he was there to direct traffic and keep us on the timeline. The layout of the target was still unfamiliar. I could see a diagram on one wall showing the compound and the arrow-like shape of its walls. I knew the guest house was a peripheral assignment. I'd be lying if I told you for a split second I didn't wish I was going to be part of the team that was tasked with going to the roof of the main building, called A1. If all went as planned, they would be the first team to make entry into the third floor, where bin Laden was thought to be living. That wish quickly faded, and I focused on what I was tasked with. Plenty of action to go around, and I was just happy to be a part of the mission. Check, I said, studying the chart. Is Will coming back for this? Will rounded out my team. He was assigned to our sister squadron, which was already based in Jalalabad, Afghanistan. A self-taught Arabic speaker, Will would be able to communicate with bin Laden's family. You'll link up with Will and Jabad, Mike said. I've got a meeting now, but check out the model. They spent good money on this thing. The rest of the guys should be back from breakfast in a few minutes. I walked out of the operations center and poked around the building,
sipping a coffee.
Our equipment was strewn all over the floor in a room just off the foyer. Pelican cases with weapons were open in one corner. Radios on chargers lined the far wall next to bags of tools. A chart printer was pushed into one corner. Crowding another corner were several whiteboards and easels with writing pads attached for note-taking. I found the mock-up of bin Laden's compound just outside the doors to the main briefing room. It sat on a 5-foot by 5-foot plywood base. It was made of foam. A massive wooden box secured by several padlocks sat in the corner of the room.
The box covered the model when it wasn't being used. The model showed bin Laden's house in amazing detail, right down to the small trees in the courtyard and cars in the driveway and on the road that ran along the north side of the compound.
It also had the location of the compound's gates and doors, water tanks on the roof, and even concertina wire running along the top of the wall. Grass covered the main courtyard. Even the neighbors' houses and fields were rendered in almost exact detail. Between sips of coffee, I studied the three-story house. The one-acre compound was on Kakul Road in a residential neighborhood in the city of Abbottabad. The town, north of Islamabad, Pakistan's capital, was named for British Major James Abbott. It is the home of Pakistan's military academy.
My other teammates were still eating breakfast,
so I had the model to myself. I was eager to get started, but I was still trying to wrap my head around what I learned that morning. We were finally going after Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden was born March 10th, 1957, in Riyadh. He was the seventh of 50 children. His father, Mohammed Awad bin Laden, was a construction billionaire.
And his mother, Alia Ghanem, from Syria, was his father's 10th wife.
Bin Laden barely knew his father. His parents divorced when he was 10 years old. His mother married again, and he grew up with 4 step-siblings.
In high school in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia,
Bin Laden joined an Islamic study group that memorized the entire Quran. In high school, he was exposed to fundamentalist Islam, and Bin Laden grew his beard long, like the Prophet Muhammad. Bin Laden married his cousin when he was 18 years old. They had a son in 1976, the same year Bin Laden graduated. He went to King Abdul Aziz University in Jeddah and earned a degree in public administration. When the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979, Bin Laden relocated to Peshawar, Pakistan, and later Afghanistan. As a Muslim, it was his duty to fight the invading Soviets, he claimed. He built camps and trained mujahideen, sometimes using aid from the United States. When the war ended in 1989, Bin Laden returned to Saudi Arabia, but was disgusted by what he considered the corrupt royal government. In 1992, he spoke out against the Saudi government and was banished to Sudan. A year later, he formed Al-Qaeda, meaning the foundation, or the base, in Arabic. His goal was to start a war with the United States to rally Muslims to create a single Arab country across the Middle East. His war against the United States started in 1996 when Al-Qaeda blew up a truck in Saudi Arabia, killing U.S. troops stationed there. Under pressure from the international community, the Sudanese government exiled him, and Bin Laden fled to Afghanistan and the protection of the Taliban. In 1998, Al-Qaeda became a household name when his group bombed U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. The attacks killed close to 300 people. He followed up the embassy attacks by bombing the USS Cole in Aden Harbor in 2000. But his most decisive blows were the 4 attacks on September 11, 2001. His followers killed almost 3,000 civilians in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania. After coalition forces toppled the Taliban in 2001, Bin Laden went into hiding after narrowly escaping capture by coalition forces at Tora Bora in Afghanistan. For the last 10 years, coalition forces, including the United States, had been hunting for him along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. Besides the 2007 spin-up, all of the intelligence we received had him hiding in Pakistan. Soon, my teammates started to come in from breakfast. I was still studying the model when Tom walked into the room. He was one of the team leaders on Chalk 1, and his team was responsible for clearing the first floor of the main building, called A1. "They call him the Pacer, because he walks for hours. They keep seeing the Pacer there," Tom said, as he pointed to a courtyard on the east side of the compound. "According to what the intel folks are saying, he walks out in the garden area to exercise from time to time. They think the Pacer is UBL. Walt and Charlie came in next. They both had big grins on their faces. "You called it," I said to Charlie. "How did they find him?" "One of his couriers," Charlie said. "He has 2 guys working for him." The day before, the CIA had briefed my teammates on the road to Abbottabad, essentially how they found Bin Laden. In the operations center, there were several booklets full of intelligence about the area and Bin Laden. While we waited for the others to arrive from breakfast, I started to read the briefings. I was a day behind and wanted to get up to speed before the serious planning started. Public sources later confirmed that the target compound, worth close to $1 million, was built in 2005, close to Pakistan's military academy. It was much larger than other houses in the area and didn't have a telephone or an internet connection. The walls were built higher on the southern side of the compound to prevent people seeing inside the courtyard. Those walls blocked the view of the 2nd and 3rd floors. The windows on both the 2nd and 3rd floors of the main building were blacked out, so no one could see in or out. There was no evidence the Pacer had any contact outside of the compound. The residents burned their trash and had very little contact with their neighbors. One of the people known to live at the compound was Ahmed Al-Kuwaiti. The CIA learned of Ahmed al-Kuwaiti after the interrogation of a man named Mohammed al-Khatani, a Saudi citizen and the alleged 20th hijacker, on September 11, 2001. Immigration agents barred him from entering the United States in August 2001 because they thought he was trying to immigrate illegally to the United States. Investigators found out later that Mohammed Atta, one of the leaders of the plot, was waiting for him at the Orlando airport that day. Al-Khatani was sent back to Dubai, only to get captured in the Battle of Tora Bora in December 2001 and sent to the prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. When his fingerprints came back as the same man sent back by immigration, interrogators went to work over several months in 2002 and 2003. Al-Khatani eventually told them that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the planner of the September 11th attacks, sent him to the United States.
He also admitted to meeting bin Laden and receiving terrorist training,
and identified a man named Ahmad al-Kuwaiti as one of bin Laden's couriers and right-hand men.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was by this time in American custody as well,
also acknowledged he knew al-Kuwaiti, but stressed that the courier was not part of al-Qaeda. Then, in 2004, Hassan Gul was captured. Gul was a courier and al-Qaeda agent. He told intelligence officials al-Kuwaiti was close to bin Laden. When interrogators questioned Khalid Sheikh Mohammed about it again, he downplayed al-Kuwaiti's role. Mohammed's successor, Abu Faraj Alibi, captured by the Pakistanis in 2005, told interrogators he hadn't seen al-Kuwaiti in a while. Since both Mohammed and Alibi dismissed al-Kuwaiti's role when asked about him, intelligence analysts began to believe he might be with bin Laden. The CIA knew that al-Kuwaiti and his brother, 33-year-old Abrar Ahmed al-Kuwaiti, had worked for bin Laden in the past. The agency started to track Ahmed al-Kuwaiti in Pakistan, hoping he would lead them to his brother and then to bin Laden. Then, during an intercepted call to his family in 2010, one of his family members asked him what he was doing for work. For the most part, al-Kuwaiti had been savvy and kept his employer a secret. So when the family member asked what he was doing for work, al-Kuwaiti said he was doing what he used to do. That subtle answer connected some dots and provided a good starting point for this operation. It was all circumstantial evidence, but it was all we had to go on. The CIA started to track Ahmed al-Kuwaiti, watching his patterns. They noticed he drove a white truck with a picture of a rhino on the spare tire cover. The CIA eventually tracked the truck back to the compound in Abbottabad, which now sat in model form in front of me. The CIA assessment said bin Laden lived on the third floor of A1, the main building. His son, Khalid, lived on the second floor. The CIA expected at least one or two wives and a dozen kids.
Kids are typically found at most targets we assault, so this was an issue we were very familiar with.
Jay and Mike had helped plan the mission's broad strokes in Washington weeks before, but it was our job to get into the weeds and really put the plan to the test. We knew our capabilities better than anyone, and since we were being trusted to execute the operation, we would also have a critical role in the planning. We all gathered around the model as Jay and Mike started talking about where the planning was to date.
Since the guys had been at it for 24 hours, the broad strokes of the plan had started to come together.
"We're gonna fly to the X," Jay said. "Chalk one will rope into the courtyard."
Moving over to the south side of the model, Jay pointed at the guest house, designated C1.
"Mark, you and your crew are responsible for C1, Jay said. "Your team will move directly to the guest house. The sniper will clear the carport and then set up on the roof. You guys will clear and secure C1. Ahmed al-Kuwaiti lives in the house with his wife and kids. When you're finished, move to backfill Tom's team in A1.
The remaining assaulters in Chalk 1, led by Tom, would split up and make their way to A1.
"Charlie and Walt will move to the north door of A1 and wait," Jay said. "They think the Pacer typically uses that door. The CIA's assessment says there is likely a spiral staircase that leads up to his living quarters on the third floor."
Tom and his team would move to the southern door, enter, and clear the first floor. The courier's brother, Abrar Ahmed al-Kuwaiti, was thought to live on the first floor of the building with his family. Based on what Tom saw inside, his team would either clear through to the north door or let Charlie and Walt in. If blocked, they would exit and loop around to the north door. We have no idea of the layout inside the house, other than we suspect that the house is cut into two living areas, Jay said. So Charlie and Walt will hold their position until Tom gives them the all clear to breach. Meanwhile, the second helicopter, carrying Chalk 2, would drop off a 5-person team north of the compound that would act as external security. Two assaulters and the CAD, Combat Assault Dog, would patrol the perimeter of the compound. The dog would be used to track down squirters. The remaining two assaulters and the interpreter would position themselves just to the northeast corner of the compound to deal with possible onlookers or local police. This external security job was actually one of the biggest and most dangerous positions on the raid. If we ran long on target, they would have to deal with first responders, most likely police, and the threat of military forces showing up. It wasn't the sexy mission, but it was absolutely essential and could end up being the most dynamic. Once outer security is dropped off,
the helo will pick up and hover above A1,
and the remaining assaulters are going to rope onto the roof, make their way down onto the third floor balcony, and clear the third deck. If the intelligence was correct and everything went according to plan, that was the team that was most likely to encounter bin Laden first. The rest of the brief, Jay and Mike spent going over the load plan. Finally, they designated several pro words for the operation. Pro words are one-word messages that relay information in an efficient manner. This kept radio traffic to a minimum and made passing information more reliable. On this mission, we chose pro words with a Native American theme. UBL is Geronimo, Jay said. The mission briefing took about an hour, and when we were done, Mike and Jay left.
Now you guys shoot holes in this, Mike said. Jay and I have been looking at this for several weeks now. You guys got it yesterday. Take some time and really get into the weeds.
We tried never to fall in love with a plan because that breeds complacency. The first thing we tried to do was find an alternate way to approach the target. No one wanted to fly to the X. We'd given up doing that years ago. We were more comfortable being dropped off and patrolling to the compound. Our tactics had evolved over the years into being as sneaky as we could, so we could keep the element of surprise until the very last second. The reconnaissance and sniper teams studied satellite images, trying to find landing zones within 4 to 6 kilometers of the target, but none of the routes seemed to work. The compound was in a residential area. All of the landing zones were either too close to urban areas, or we'd have to walk down city streets. The risks of getting compromised during our infill were too high. In the end, flying to the X was the lesser of two evils. It would be loud, but it would be fast. We couldn't risk being compromised during the foot patrol. Huddled in separate corners of the operations center, the teams got together individually to plan their part. Beyond our personal gear, we started to divide up our team gear list. A ladder, a sledgehammer, and explosives.
I'll need the ladder to climb the carport, the sniper said.
The collapsible ladder was heavy and burdensome.
Mike said he'd carry it in on his back during the fast rope so I can provide better security.
We positioned two snipers, one in each door of Chalk 1, to cover us as we roped into the compound. We didn't need someone walking into the compound with an AK-47 and shooting us as we slid down the rope.
Since Will isn't here to argue, he gets the sledge, I said with a smirk. I'll carry two breaching charges and a set of bolt cutters.
A breaching charge was a 2-inch thick strip of explosives. The charge was about 12 inches long with a strip of adhesive that ran along its spine, so we could stick it to the door. Once initiated, it would explode in about 3 seconds and usually tear a door open by cutting through the locking mechanism. The goal of each team was to be self-sufficient. The last thing anybody wanted was to have to call another team over to help because they didn't have the right equipment. A woman from the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, a blonde in her early 30s, took care of the maps and satellite images for us. She provided any detail, big or small. Kneeling down to look at the mock-up, I studied the door leading into the guest house.
Hey, are these doors on C1 inward or outward opening? I asked her.
She was back in a few minutes with the answer.
Double metal door, she said, opens outwards.
It was like that all week. If we had a question, they had the answer. including where the Pacer walked, who else lived on the compound, which gates were locked or unlocked, and even where they frequently parked their cars. They had a huge number of images from drones and satellites